page today and our last one for the June sitting prior to our recess and then September sitting. 99-0752 Sierra Street, E. Williams. Ms. Hennick appearing for Mr. Williams, Assistant State Public Defender.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Ellen Hennick, and I am here on behalf of the defendant, Adrian Williams. I am here today basically asking for a change in the rule on guilty pleas. I am asking that this court require that when a court is not going to follow the recommendations in a guilty plea agreement, that the court inform the defendant that it thinks it may not or might not or it looks unlikely that it will do so, and offer the defendant an opportunity to withdraw his plea. I am not asking that the court require that there be any specific statement as to how that might not be followed or why.
Counsel, this has bothered me, and your opening statement points right to it. Is there a place in your brief that you can point to the rule that you want the court to adopt? Because I like to see the words. And in your opening statement, you said that the court may not, might not, looks unlikely. And to me, those are differences. To say the court, to advise the defendant, the court may not, is probably what we have now, or close to it now, you know, with the kind of admonition, you know, that I'm not bound to follow the plea agreement. That's, I think, easily translated into may not, may. That's different than what you have in your brief, I think, on page 8, bottom of the page 8, which says, likely will. What is it?
All right.
Can I look at the words, or can you tell me what the words are that you want this rule to be?
All right. I think it's a combination of page 4 to 5 is the original, at the bottom, that bottom paragraph is the original formulation I had of that. Inform when the terms of the agreement are unacceptable. I think if I were to say what unacceptable means was, I think I would use the word probably will. I think that would be what I would be comfortable with, and I'm not sure that I formulated it specifically there. But if you were to say, are unacceptable means probably will not, I would be comfortable with that. Now, the reason that I'm advocating this is because I believe that we have been slowly moving in plea bargaining, and I think some things have changed. What I'm really asking for is let's bring what's going on into the light, have some truth. As we've gone into truth in sentencing, let's go into truth in plea bargaining and make it clear to everybody what's going on here and what's not going on.
Well, why isn't it clear now? The defendant is told, we hope by counsel, by defense counsel, that an agreement can be reached on the following terms, but that it doesn't bind the judge. The judge can do whatever the judge believes is correct in the judge's discretion up to the maximum. So it could be from parole, if that was available, probation to life or whatever. And there's no guarantee. And once we make the deal, you can't pull out. And if you plead guilty, you're waiving jury trial, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Then the defendant goes into court, and the judge says the same thing.
I think.
So why do you think it's not truth then?
I think part of what happens is, first of all, there's always a problem when I'm not always sure. The best counsel explains this very, very well. I have no doubt of that. Unfortunately, as we all know, there are times when things are not explained as well as they should be. whether through inability to articulate well with a client, whether through clients who have trouble grasping large amounts of information at a given time. And one of the things that happens during pleas is defendants are extremely nervous, they're under pressure, and they're trying to make decisions. One of the things that happens is there is a lot of information that is being given. I think that this piece of information is one of the most counterintuitive pieces of information for defendants. Hey, I've made a deal. The state's going to recommend it. Most of the time, what I've seen is, hey, they seem to think that that means not that the judge can go anywhere, but that that's what's going to happen. What this does is this sort of puts a stop. It says, whoa, this is an important piece of information. You need to think about this. Because there are a lot of pieces of information that are floating around. And often, if you're standing in courtrooms, what happens is you go down that whole plea questionnaire with a whole list of questions. And it's very thorough, but it's also a heck of a lot of words. And the truth is, a lot of defendants are not terribly articulate. And I think that there's a difference between emphasizing something a little bit with action and doing it with words.
Well, how many times would you want this done? So they come in, if you would prevail, the defendant and counsel for the defense and counsel for the state come in, and the judge says, no go. I'm not going to take your sentence. You may withdraw your plea of guilty. Defendant withdraws the plea of guilty. Okay. Now what happens? They go back to negotiate and they up a bit. Then they go back to maybe the same judge, maybe a different judge, and the judge says no. Then they go back a third time.
Is that
the way this is going to work?
That's not the way I'm contemplating it working. First,
one kick at the cat.
I would be comfortable. I certainly think one kick at the can would be much better than what we have now, yes. If this court were to come up with a rule that says one kick at the can, I think we would be much farther along than we are now. My guess is that, as a practical matter, that one would not see very many multiple kicks at the can because the pressures that induce a guilty plea continue. And very often, and you see as you read transcript of transcript, and I'm sure this court has seen the same thing. There are an awful lot of cases in which it may not be solely the sentence that's at issue, in which case it's not going to be much of an issue. You get cases in which defendants plead in exchange for, I'm just not going to make a recommendation at sentencing. And so I think that you're going to find that, as a general rule, many defendants are going to go ahead and do it anyway. I know that there are courtrooms in which this has happened, and it does go ahead.
How would this work on the system overall?
I'm sorry, I'm having trouble.
How would this work on the system, the judicial administration of justice? Right now, would this affect in any way the substitution situation, do you think? In other words, what you're advocating, as I can see, is that, of course, the judge would simply say, I'm not going to accept the plea bargain. Then what happens?
Well, first of all, the time for substitution would have been passed, so it would not affect substitution at all.
Okay. So what your client would have would be the ability then to decide whether he or she would like either to negotiate some more or have a trial. This is what you're contemplating. That I'm wondering if it would have an impact on the number of trials. Let's try this case rather than, to plead it out or to re-examine our position as a practical matter.
Well, as a practical matter, I think you have to make a decision here. How important are you saying this expectation is to the defendant? If you're saying, hey, he's really not expecting the judge to go along, then it shouldn't have any impact at all. If you're saying what we do now does that, it should have no impact at all because it shouldn't change anything. If you're saying, and I think to be fair that I am saying, that some of those clients are expecting the judge to go along, there may be a slight increase in trials. I'm not comfortable saying that having a slight increase in trials is necessarily a bad thing. But if you're saying, hey, he doesn't have any more than that and has an expectation now, it should not change anything at all.
Well, except now you'd say to the client, you've got nothing to lose because if he doesn't go along with it or she doesn't go along with it, we just got a trial, which is exactly where we are now.
Well, I think that that's true in some instances. In many instances, when you have a guilty plea, there are a lot of other things going on. And one of those things is judges often take into account in sentencing, not always, but very, very often, whether somebody has accepted responsibility. That pressure stays there regardless of what's going on with the plea agreement, for example. And there may be some other pressures that would play in there, too, having to do with defendants who really would know that in order to defend their case they'd have to get up on the stand and may not want to do so. There may be other pressures there. Those would remain.
Well, speaking of pressures, though, doesn't this create incredible pressure on the sentencing judge just to rubber stamp the plea agreement and take his or her own role as an independent arbiter out of the picture or at least diminish it? And that's clearly not an appropriate result, because by the time you get to the end, particularly in felonies where a PSI has been ordered, by the time you get to the end of a sentencing proceeding, you know, you've been through several court proceedings already, you've heard the prosecutor, you've heard the victim, you've heard the defense attorney, you've heard the defendant, and then you decide, you know, I can't go along with this recommendation. And if the whole thing is unraveled at that point, but there's a cost to the system with that. So doesn't this create incredible pressure on the sentencing judge just to rubber stamp everything?
I think if a judge is smart, what it creates pressure on is the prosecutor and the defense attorney to get their act together when they are negotiating pleas and have the information together. When there are surprises in the PSI, it is often because somebody hasn't done their homework and doesn't know either, because you can do this plea, and if you think you've got something that might be a little odd, you're going to have to stand there and say, look, this is why I think this is okay.
But you're not arguing for this rule because there are surprises in the PSI that cause the judge to have a desire to exceed the recommendation. We're talking about a situation where a judge just may have a different judgment about the proper result. You know, whether or not based on something that came up later on in the process, or maybe just because of a different judgment.
What I'm saying is that the extent to which that pressure exists, to some extent, depends on how much information the judge is given initially. I mean, you can, by the time of the plea agreement, you have the judge may not have, but certainly the parties have, the client's record and can make the judge aware of that. That tends to be one of the things that sometimes crops up in PSIs and causes that problem. Certainly you can make the judge aware of, well, prosecutor should have talked to the victim. It can make the judge aware that the victim is unlikely to be happy with this or is likely to be. So some of that, I think, can be worked out within the system. Does it create some pressures on judges? It may. I'll be honest, it may create some pressure. On the other hand, what you have in exchange for that is, I think what you get in exchange for that, I think whenever you talk about changing rules, you talk about trade-offs. What you get in exchange for that are a couple of things. I think you probably get less pressure on the end of appeals, because one of the biggest things that happen is, what determines appeals are really two things. One is whether there are issues. But a client doesn't always pursue all of their issues. Whether they do often is less, at least in my experience, has been less because of what's actually happened and more because of their perception that something hasn't happened the way they were expecting it. Interestingly enough, it may or may not be. Certainty seems to make for less of that.
Counsel, I follow on Justice Sykes' skirt tails or something like that.
I'm wearing pants too.
The chart in your brief, as I counted, reflects that in varying situations,
38 states allow the defendant an opportunity to withdraw the plea. Some of those 38 states make a distinction between an agreement for recommendation or agreement for a specific disposition. But in your chart, 38 states had somewhere an opportunity to withdraw or letting the defendant draw. So that, and I know that the rules are not necessarily uniform, but that's the bottom line. So that leads me to conclude, well, it must be workable. I mean, 38 states in some form are doing it. And yet, but Justice Sykes raises the concern. The reality is, and please, oftentimes I'm there, I'm sitting, I'm taking a plea, it comes in at some kind of run-of-the-mill burglary, you know, nothing. They come with a plea agreement. It's supposed to be a motion hearing. They end up, they're going to come with a plea agreement. I take the plea agreement. I order a PSI 2 days before the scheduled sentencing, which is 60 days from the time that I had the plea was entered. I read the PSI, and then I start finding out more about the case. And oftentimes I go into a sentencing with a kind of a ballpark, a framework based on the PSI. But I listen to the prosecutor. I listen to the defense attorney. I listen to the defendant during the allocution. And I listen to witnesses. And then that ballpark gets shifted. That's the way I used to do it. So how does that play out in the run-of-the-mill, and I'm not talking about a misdemeanor, but where you have a pre-sentence investigation, how does your rule play out? How is it workable? I don't know 60 days beforehand. I don't really know what I'm going to do.
I think that the way it plays out, and I'll be honest, I've seen it play out. This is not the first state I've practiced it. Is that, as I said, I think what starts happening is you start get, normally here, please, you don't get a whole lot of information with the plea. This is what the agreement is, we're pleading to this, blah, 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 blah. You get more information here when there's dismissal of a charge. Why is that? Because the judge is going to have to make a decision and everybody knows it. I think what happens as a practical matter is you start getting more information at the time of the plea. You start getting at least a preview of what the prosecutor thinks is important and what the defense thinks is important. That preview probably gives you some idea of what that framework may be. And I think you can spot when that framework and what's being proposed are not matching. And I think that very often the way it plays out in other states is that's where it really gets identified. That it doesn't tend to be around the edges. It tends to be when that framework and the information that's coming in are not matching. And if you're getting that information earlier, you can see that earlier. We don't see it till late because there's no incentive for anybody in the system to give it until late.
So you think that the judge, before the judge sees the pre-sentence investigation report, but hears both sides, the judge is going to say, hey, I don't need to hear any more. I'm not taking this. Is that what you view?
I think that you would find that there are courtrooms in this state in which that's exactly what happens, where a judge will say, you know, this isn't sounding right to me.
When would you have the court tell the defendant this?
I think it's best if you can do it right at the plea. I think it's best for the entire system if you can do it at that point. But, there may be times, and I'm contemplating times, when in exchange for this you do get to the point where you get that PSI and the judge has to do it at that point. And there may be times when that will mean that something everybody thought was going to end is going to end up in a trial.
This phenomenon of exceeding the negotiated recommendation happened with great regularity in my courtroom in Milwaukee County. And I would foresee having to reject almost every single plea on its face, even, you know, before accepting it. in order not to bind myself to the recommendation. Doesn't this just completely undercut the rule that the judge is not a party to plea negotiations, is not bound by the plea negotiation, that what the defendant is bargaining for is a certain sort of advocacy from both parties of a certain sort of a sentence, not an end result?
Actually, the defendant is bargaining for something far less than advocacy, and that's part of the problem.
But a prosecutor
has to propose something. He can't overtly undercut it, but he doesn't have to truly advocate for that position. And I think if you look at Poole, you'll see that, the case law in Poole. On the other hand, I think that a situation in which you are almost routinely exceeding the sentencing recommendation is actually the easiest situation. So you always say, you know, I'm not likely to follow that. What do you want to do? And then that defendant at least knows where he stands. I think that's probably an easier situation than where you have to really weigh it carefully and start looking at all of the factors involved. I think it's much easier there. And at least then, see, one of the things that happens is that the current system, nobody intends to take advantage of anybody. But if you've got an inexperienced defense attorney, an attorney coming in from another county, an inexperienced defendant, they are the least likely to know what the judge is likely to do. Prosecutors, in many cases, are in that same courtroom much more often, and they're in a much better position to know.
And you, counsel, Mr. Castle, Assistant Attorney General, senior before but new title, Mr. Castle.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. I'm Assistant Attorney Jeffrey Castle, appearing today on behalf of the state of Wisconsin. This case presents two distinct issues for the Court, and lest we lose sight of the immediate case that the Court accepted for review, I'd like to focus the Court's attention just for a moment, at least, on that. Because the case comes to the Court in the context of a motion by Defendant Adrian Williams to withdraw his guilty plea. That plea was entered following plea discussions with the prosecutor, under which the defendant agreed to plead guilty to two counts to which he was charged, and the prosecutor agreed to make a sentencing recommendation, a four-month sentence on one of the counts, a three-month consecutive sentence on the other counts. The defense counsel at the time of sentencing agreed that the sentences should be 4 months and 3 months, but argued that they should be made to run concurrent. But at the sentencing hearing, the trial court, after hearing from not only counsel, but talking to the defendant at some length, concluded that that was the sentence recommended by the prosecution was too short, that the maximum sentence was called for in this case, and in fact imposed the maximum sentence. At that point, the defendant moved to withdraw his guilty pleas. And because the motion to withdraw was made after imposition of sentence, the motion is governed by the manifest injustice standard. So I think the first question that this court should address in the context of this particular case is it a manifest injustice to follow the procedure that this court has approved repeatedly for at least 30 years, since at least the Young case? Because, as the Chief Justice's question pointed out, this is a case where the defendant was told ahead of time by the court in the plea colloquy, also signed a plea questionnaire acknowledging that the court was not bound by the recommendation. There has never been any argument by the defendant in this case that he did not understand that the recommendation was not exactly that, a recommendation. Now, we've heard counsel talk in generalities about what defendants may or may not understand. But I think it's important to point out that the record in this case does not contain an assertion by the defendant that he did not understand what was happening, that there was anything unclear, that there was anything other than a knowing, voluntary, and intelligent plea.
His position, I gather, is that the Wisconsin process is just unfair, and that the court ought to change the process. The court made the process. The court can change it. And as you probably know, when there was a rule change, I was in the minority, but said I thought that the rules should be changed. So why now should I change my mind?
Well, I think the experience of the last 15 years has shown that no rule change is necessary. At the time, in the mid-80s, I think there was a lot of focus and discussion about plea agreements and plea bargaining, and it was under a lot of fire at that point. I think we have seen the development in the law to really help ensure, not just through the case law, but through the use of plea questionnaires, since the Court of Appeals explicitly gave its approval in the Moldendorfer case in 1987, the use of plea questionnaires that explicitly alert the defendant as to what is happening have become uniform.
My objection is not that the defendant doesn't know, frankly, or that the defendant hasn't been told. I'm going to assume defendant has been told and defendant should know. I mean, I understand people don't have the same skills in digesting information, but we've just got to take it the defendant does know under this record. But it's unfair for putting the defendant under this kind of pressure, and that it just fosters guilty pleas because people can't afford to take the chance of going to trial and getting a higher sentence, being charged with a larger offense, several offenses. And so you drop charges and you give the recommended sentences for less. I mean, that's why we all talk about plea agreements, but out on the street it's called plea bargains.
And I don't think adoption of this rule will do anything one way or another to change those pressures. There's still going to be the same pressures on a defendant to cut a deal, to perhaps reduce exposure by the reduction of charges. I'm not sure I understand at all how adopting a rule that says you get to withdraw your plea if the judge announces that she's probably going to exceed the recommendation, how that changes the pressures at all.
You're in a unique situation because your office in 1985, and that's by your office in 1985. Supported, in fact, strongly supported the change being advocated at that time. The reasons advanced by your office is that a change would make the process, number one, more uniform, number two, more fair, and number three, more deserving of public confidence. And I put in more. I inserted that wasn't in your letter, but those are the three reasons. To enhance those three goals. Do you think now unlike your office's position 15 years ago, there's a need to make the process more fair?
Well, I think to the extent that the question implies that there is anything unfair about the current system, I would say there is nothing unfair.
What has changed then, since apparently we didn't change the system, but has changed in the 15 years,
And I don't want to be unfair. You didn't write this letter, you know. It looks like Assistant Attorney Generals Douglas Haig and Jim Jeffries were part of the Judicial Council. You didn't vote for it, you know. You've got to sign this case. Now you've got to live with this letter and live with their voting for this proposal. That aside, but you're stuck with it, okay? So you have to answer.
Answer the question.
What's changed in 15 years, because we have the same thing, that makes it more fair, more uniform, and more deserving of public confidence?
Well, I think the case law that has developed in the last 15 years has even further strengthened the protections by laying out more about what is necessary in the colloquy to ensure that the plea is knowing voluntary. And I think that's really one of, in terms of what is unfair, as I understand the defendant's argument, is kind of the subtext that it really is not a knowing and intelligent plea because the defendant doesn't really know what's going on.
The defendant gets whipsawed.
And I think this court has gone a long way in terms of in cases that came out, for example, shortly after the 1985 rulemaking proceeding, cases like Bangert that really have laid out what it is that needs to happen during the plea colloquy.
Okay.
In terms of uniformity, I think there probably is somewhat greater uniformity as the use of plea questionnaires has become widely accepted now as a result of the court's order last October. It's going to be mandatory in the state to use the plea questionnaire approved by the judicial conference, and that lays out the same warning. And frankly, it's just 15 years of experience have shown that this system really is working.
I look at your letter and see the three goals of your office. The proposed Judicial Council rule, however, had other goals. They had two goals that was contained in the Judicial Council note. And they said the proposed rule amendment number one is intended to give defendants relief from certain plea agreements not approved by the court. And number two, this is what I'm emphasizing, to minimize post-conviction attacks on sentences and probation orders. I've read the minutes of the Judicial Council, and there is several references to, look, the reason for proposing this rule in 1985 is to minimize the post-conviction attacks on sentences and probation orders. How has that changed? We're here on a case involving that issue. I think we're holding two cases. I don't know if there are any others or if the three that we have are the universe of all of the cases, but I would guess not. So how has that changed?
That hasn't changed. And I think it is certainly true that one of the things that a defendant's disappointment with a sentence is certainly one of the things that may impel the defendant to want to appeal. But there are other trade-offs. I think counsel for the defendant agrees that there will be more trials. I think it is inevitable that if this proposal were adopted, there would be more trials. Otherwise, this is just a hollow exercise.
Has that been the experience in other states? We have that chart. Is that something?
I have not seen any empirical evidence, and that gives me one of the arguments I make in terms of this court's adopting a rule is that's one reason this court should not make a determination on this kind of rule in this kind of proceeding. It should be done in a rulemaking proceeding where there would be opportunities to gather information from other states. There would be opportunities to examine how these various proposals have played out in other states. Justice Bradley, you mentioned, I think your count was 38 states But a pretty large percentage of those states have adopted the federal model that, as you pointed out, distinguishes between agreed-upon dispositions and recommendations. And I think it would be important for this court, if it were going to seriously consider adopting a rule, to look at the experience in other states. That's not something that in the context of a litigated case that the court really, I don't think, has, certainly the parties don't have the capability of mustering that kind of evidence.
The federal system puts all the power in the hands of the prosecutor, right, in a whole lot of different ways. And we have chosen in this state not to go that route, even in our fledgling truth and sentencing experiment right now. We still vest absolute sentencing discretion in the judge.
Right. I'm certainly not advocating the federal model.
Right. No, I know. So what, is there any, you know, rationale for going the federal route since our sentencing philosophy in this state is so different?
No, but there are other variations even among those who haven't adopted the federal model. For example, some states give both sides an opportunity to withdraw from the plea. Would be in the case where the trial court says, you know, I'm going to impose a sentence less severe than the prosecutor has recommended. Certainly we have all seen times when that does happen. And the prosecution may have agreed to dismiss charges. Well, some states, I believe it's Alaska and New Mexico, say in that situation the state should have an opportunity to withdraw from the plea bargain. I think it's understandable why the defendant has made this specific proposal. It's a step back from what the court rejected in the 1985 rulemaking proceeding, that the involvement of the trial court in the procedure is not quite as blatant, and that's clearly a major concern and has been a major concern of this court. But I think it's important to emphasize that the trial court, even under the defendant's proposal, I think, is going to become involved in the plea negotiations kind of in a silent way. I think the Chief Justice's question raised that in terms of the back and forth. Well, where is the limit? Counsel for the defendant said, well, we can live with just one kick at the can. That was not a proposal in the brief. There's no obvious reason why it should be one or two or three kicks in the can. But I think if you have a procedure where it goes back and forth and the parties come to the court and say, we're making a we've reached a deal, the prosecution's going to drop one of the charges, defendant's going to plead to two of the charges, the prosecutor's going to recommend 7 years, and the court at some point along the way, and I think that's a very important question as to at what point, says, I can't live with 7 years. I'm informing you I'm likely to exceed that, but I'm not going to tell you what it is that would be acceptable. And you can almost envision the parties with rounds of negotiations kind of playing a game of 20 questions with the court. Well, would you take 7? Would you take 9? Would you take 12 years? Finally, the court says, bingo, 12 years, and the plea is accepted. And I think the situation is even going to get more difficult under truth in sentencing, because then under truth in sentencing, we have two components to a sentence, and presumably two components to the prosecutor's recommendation, both the term of confinement and the term of extended supervision. I haven't heard the defendant address this issue. What happens if the judge says, well, I can live with the term of confinement, but I think this defendant needs a lot more supervision than you're recommending? Does the defendant get to withdraw the plea at that point? So I think the advent of truth in sentencing makes this much more complicated. One thing I tried to do before argument, which I will confess an inability to do, was try to match up some of these different state procedures with states that have adopted truth in sentencing. And many states have adopted variations on truth in sentencing. And from the little I was able to find out, I haven't really succeeded in doing that. But I think that's a really, given the variations in truth in sentencing and the variations in the plea procedures, I think that really calls into question the need to get that kind of information before the court implements a new procedure, because frankly I think it's whatever the court does, if it were to adopt a new rule, is a more complicated situation because of truth in sentencing.
Could there be any change in the current rules?
No. It's the state's position that the venerable legal maxim, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, applies here. But the system.
Well, what about those situations that are alluded to where the prosecutor strikes a bargain with the defendant, knowing full well that it will not be honored by the court?
I think there is a role for defense counsel in this, and defense counsel has a job to do too. Defense counsels should be advising his or her client that, you know, we've got a recommendation here, but given the charges, given your background, given the court, it's not very likely the court is going to go along with it. So I think we can't view this as just the responsibility of the prosecutor.
How does this current proposal compare with the proposal of the Judicial Council in 1985?
I think the major difference, as I understand both this proposal and the earlier proposal, is what the trial court would inform the defendant. In 1985, the Judicial Council proposal, as I understand it, would have required the trial court to announce its intended disposition and then call on the defendant to, in effect, reaffirm the plea or withdraw it. Under the current proposal, if I'm understanding it correctly, the trial court would simply say, I probably will exceed the recommended sentence.
And at that point, ask for a withdrawal if they want to.
And then offer the defendant an opportunity to withdraw. I think we heard during counsel for the defense's presentation a real problem with how this would work in practice, and that deals with the timing. Defense counsel said, well, ideally, these issues would be dealt with early on in the process, at the point at which the defendant has announced that he is ready to plead guilty. And I think that's a real practical problem because, as members of the court have pointed out, there often just is not enough information available at that time. I think it is unrealistic to expect there to be an adequate amount of information, particularly in cases of defendants who have a more lengthy history. The pre-sentence investigation report is an important tool. That clearly cannot be available at the time of the plea, if for no other reason than that current statute says that it can be ordered only after a conviction. So a trial court cannot say, back at the bind over, why don't we get a PSI prepared just in case there's a guilty plea so we'll have it ready. And clearly a defendant prior to conviction is not going to be spilling his guts to the PSI writer. I think it is unrealistic to, while it may be in certain circumstances difficult enough to get full cooperation with the defendant, clearly prior to the adjudication of guilt, That's not going to happen. And the court has noted that in preparing a PSI, the cooperation of the defendant is essential. Well, I think we face the specter of, as Justice Sykes pointed out, going through a procedure where there have been pretrial proceedings, there's been a preliminary hearing, maybe a suppression motion. Finally, down the road as trial approaches, there's a guilty plea. But the court at that point just isn't going to have enough information. So then there has to be the ordering of a pre-sentence investigation. In some counties, that may take many weeks to prepare. Meanwhile, victims are left in limbo. Witnesses may become more difficult to find. And the state, frankly, may have a harder time prosecuting its case.
Counsel, one of the things we were earlier discussing is these various states, just as a threshold question, parenthetically, I guess. Do you take issue with the accuracy of the chart that's part of the appendix in the Assistant State Public Defender's brief?
I do, and in our brief, we challenge the numbers in some of the specific states. We agree that of those states that have addressed the issue, a majority, I think, by our count, was about 24 states, have gone along with something fairly similar to what the defendant has suggested. By our count, about 20 states do what Wisconsin does, whether it's under something like the federal rule dealing with recommendations. But in our brief at pages, I believe it is, 23, 24, we do our own count. And for the most part, we're in agreement, but a few states here and there, we disagree.
One of the things in looking at the notes of the Judicial Council that comes to mind is, you know, there's a hesitation. Well, this is new. How is it going to play out? Yet I see on the subcommittee and the committee, we had Judge Barlin, Judge Mize, I think, chaired the subcommittee. Judge Pappas was on the committee at the time, the Judicial Council. And I note Judge Pappas is saying that he gives the defendant an opportunity to withdraw his plea, that he tells the defendant he's not going to go along, he may not go along with it, that he gives the defendant an opportunity to withdraw his plea even after the pre-sentence report is filed because he agrees that knowing what the penalty is, the state is seeking bears on the fairness of the agreement. However, he does not disclose to the defendant what sentence he intends to impose until after the plea is taken and judgment entered. I mean, my point in reading that is I think there are a lot of judges in this state that do it the way that Judge Pappas does. Thank you. is it still willing?
The state is not suggesting that it would be the end of the judicial system as we know it were this proposal to be adopted. We can't do that with a straight face when 24 states have adopted it. But your remarks about some counties and some judges doing it reminds me that the last time the court considered this, one of the groups that the court was very much interested in hearing from was the state's trial judges. Not only did it send the court send the proposal to the judicial conference, it also apparently surveyed the state's trial judges. Well, we haven't heard from the state's trial judges. That was 15 years ago. Reading at least between the lines, it seems pretty clear that the judges 15 years ago didn't think much of the proposal. But I think it would be important not only to know what the trial judges think, but to understand what the current practices are. We all have our impression, or at the appellate level, we read transcripts or we talk to prosecutors and judges, or some members have more recent experience on the trial bench. But I think it would be important to know what the judges are currently doing and what they think of this proposal. And that's not something that the court can do in the context of this proceeding. I think in my brief I said that the defendant has suggested, well, there's always amicus briefs as a way to get information. But trial judges cannot do that. I think under the Code of Judicial Ethics, they cannot speak out to affect the outcome of a litigated case. The only way trial judges could have an input is in a rulemaking proceeding. I'd like to end with an urging of the court that if it is considering a change in the rules, that it do two things. One, that it not do it in the context of this case, because any change that the court might consider making should be prospective only. Unless the court were to conclude that the procedure that it has explicitly approved creates a manifest injustice, there is really no reason for making that rule change applicable to pleas that already have been entered. And making that rule apply to cases in which the plea is already taken would upset settled expectations in many cases and really create a hardship both for the crime victims who thought their cases had been resolved, as well as for prosecutors who find themselves trying cases at some point long after the case had been closed.
That's what we did in Bangert, wasn't it? That the court did in Bangert. From henceforth, the court said.
Correct. I want to close with a statement by this court in a case that neither party cited in the brief because it was not specifically addressing this issue of the court exceeding a prosecutor sentencing recommendation. The case is State versus Erickson, which is cited in the rulemaking case. It's 53 with second 474, 1972. The issue in Erickson was the defendant's motion to withdraw the case, withdraw his pleas after the trial judge informed him that the judge never gave probation in this kind of case. And this court said, and I quote, "The defendant at the time of entry of plea is entitled to know what might or could happen to him, but not to an advance indication of what will happen," unquote. And I think that reasoning applies with equal force in this case and should lead the court to reject the defendant's proposal. Questions?
Could I ask one? Could you respond to the suggestion by opposing counsel that what is really necessary here before these pleas are agreed on is that you involve victims more? Is that practical?
Well, I'm not quite sure how this rule would force or prod the involvement of victims more. I think conscientious district attorneys under the victims' rights laws and with their notification to victims of their rights to notice and so on are doing that already. And frankly, I don't think this rule really does much one way or the other.
Thank you, Mr. Castle. Ms. Hennick, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
We spent a lot of time today talking about involving judges or not involving judges in plea bargaining. The truth is, judges are already involved in plea bargaining. The question is where you draw the line and how much you involve them. They're involved because an awful lot of pleas involve dismissal of charges, which cannot happen without the court. They're involved when you say, I'm only going to take pleas by a certain date, you've set your limit, and I suppose that that limit could go along with the proposal today when you're talking about one kick at the can. If you say, I'm not taking any pleas after whatever date it is, and different courts set different dates now, then presumably you're going to have to do whatever you do by then. Courts are involved in pleas simply by the fact that most judges take acceptance of responsibility into account in sentencing. That creates a certain pressure, and we all know it. So judges are to some extent involved. So to talk about judges being involved or not involved is not really what you're talking about. You're really talking about the question of how should they be involved. I think the question of whether they're involved was decided long ago.
But it's different when you're talking about a decision of whether to accept a reduction in charge or a dismissal and read-in, something of that nature, at the time of the plea, and asking a judge to essentially make a decision at the time of the plea on what the ultimate sentence is going to be. And that's basically what would have to happen here. I mean, the judge would have to say at the time of the acceptance of the plea, you know, this justice, this recommendation doesn't pass the smell test here. Either that or it's going to happen at the end of the sentencing hearing, which in most felony cases is going to be on a separate date after the preparation of a PSI, after a victim impact has been received and right of allocution has been exercised, etc., when there is tremendous pressure not to unravel everything that's been done.
I think that there are two differences. Number one, I think that to some extent, if a judge is conscientiously worrying about what the charges are, judges are making certain inquiries at that point. There are many who are.
Well, we're talking about ultimate exposure. I mean, when I would decide at the acceptance of a plea whether to accept dismissal of a charge or reduction of a charge, I'm looking at what the maximum exposure is and whether we've got a separate victim or not, that whose interests need to be taken into consideration, what the defendant's prior record is, a whole, you know, host of things, but mostly what the maximum exposure is and whether it's going to leave me with enough. I'm not looking at what the ultimate sentence is going to be at that juncture.
But, Your Honor, listen to what you're really saying. You're saying, am I going to be left with enough to sentence the way I want to sentence? And it's that same it's the same kind of ballpark you're doing here. If this plea goes through, am I left with enough? That's really the same evaluation. It's exactly the same evaluation. You're just putting it in different terms. You're just putting your cap at a different place. That's all it is. The other thing that came up was truth in sentence.
The cap is what they've agreed to. So you're saying they agree to 30 years, but the max is 250.
What I'm saying is at the point at which you're accepting that plea,
right,
you're saying, can I live within the 30?
30, right.
Yeah,
instead of whether I can live within the 250.
Right, all we're playing with is the number. The other point... The other point I wanted to make was that when we're talking about truth in sentencing, I don't think truth in sentencing affects this much one way or the other. You just say, does the proposal sound good to me or doesn't it? I mean, you could parse this out as just, does the fine sound a little bit high? That's exactly where the proposal I'm making, I think, differs from that 1985 or 86 proposal. That's exactly where I'm suggesting this court not go. So I don't think truth in sentencing affects it at all.
So you're not suggesting we adopt the 1985 proposal?
No, I'm not. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Hennick. Thank you, Mr. Castle. That concludes 99-0752CR, and the court is adjourned until... Thank you.